could make more money if they could hire more staff so they, because they could take care of more residents, but they can't do that. And they need a sort of this body to help them set the standards that are going to enable them to hire more workers.
Are workforce standards boards a relatively new idea, or does it have a longer history?
It's got a very long history, so it's both new and old. In the early sort of 1900s, in which what we call the sort of progressive era in the United States, many states, in fact, probably most states, had something akin to these sectoral standards bodies where the workers and employers and the government would set minimum standards. And then in the past, since 2018, it's been a rebirth of this idea. Probably the most well-known is in California for fast food workers that's created a standards board, and they have successfully raised a significant, quite high minimum wage for these workers just in the first year of its operation. But we also have Nevada home care workers have boards. Nevada, Minnesota has nursing homes. Then we have agriculture boards in Colorado and New York. And my view is that we will continue to see this trend spreading because of the success that the new this new wave of standards boards has created.
That's it for today's show. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is Community Radio for the Pacific Northwest, 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland. This is Matthew, and it's now time for Film at 11 with DK Holmes.
We're talking today with Foster Hirsch, who is an eminent film historian. Your earliest books were on film noir, but you've covered so many other subjects over time, including a secondary track on Broadway and theater.
Yes, I'm guilty. I'm as interested in theater as in films, which is unusual for a film historian.
Yeah.
There isn't a crossover most of the time at all.
In any case, your most recent book, about to come out in paperback, is called Hollywood and the Movies of the 50s, published by Knopf.
You mean there's going to be two other guys in on the deal, and we ain't going to know who they are?
That's right. You don't know who they are, and they don't know who you are. That makes sense to you, doesn't it?
Yes, I guess so, but I...
Makes sense to me, all right. How come we need them, though, Johnny? What are they going to do?
One of them's for the job with a rifle. None of you boys can handle that, even if you were willing to. And the other one starts the fight in the bar.
These other fellas, how much are they cutting in for? Not that I mind. Anything you do is okay, but...
These men are not going to be in on the basic scheme. They're getting paid to perform certain definite duties at a certain definite time. And they're not cutting in on the take. They'll be paid a flat price to do a straight job.
Well, if they don't know anything about the basic plan, about the job, then why are they doing it?
That's simple. These boys are straight hoods. They get paid in advance. $5,000 for the one with the rifle and $2,500 for the other.
Where's this money coming from?
That's where Marvin comes in. He's getting the $7,500 for us, and he gets it back off the top.
I wish I could do more, Johnny. It's almost not right for me to get as much as everybody else. After all I do is...
Your money counts for plenty, Marv. You don't hear any of them complaining, do you?
Sure. You're okay in our book, Marv. But look, Johnny, if these two hoods get paid in advance, how do you know they're going to do their jobs?
I'll vouch for them. These guys are pros. They can't afford to weasel out on a deal. If they did, they'd be washed up. Okay?
Okay.
Any other questions?
Well, it's a fantastic book. And in fact, let me advise readers, when you get the book, make sure you got a pad of paper next to you, because you're going to be wanting to write down a whole lot of movies that have been overlooked or undervalued, especially early noir type or action movies from the early 50s. I'm not finished with it yet. I'm up to the first and second tier actors and the conflict between of the men.
The old timers and the newcomers.
Yeah, I just got through reading about Rock Hudson, who I felt that he was so terribly abused by writers and reviewers and pundits. Well, we saw him improve on screen. He's so good in The Tarnished Angels, especially in the when he has a blow up in the newsroom, if I remember the scene correctly. Anyway,
you should mention the subtitle of the book.
Oh, okay.
That does give an indication of the range of the content.
Here it is. Here's the subtitle. Here's the full title: Hollywood and the Movies of the 50s, The Collapse of the Studio System, The Thrill of Cinerama, and the Invasion of the Ultimate Body Snatcher, Television. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Matthew, please proceed. You've got some good questions.
Well, I really loved this book, and I really liked how you structured it. As Doug puts, that we're talking about Hollywood in the 1950s, but you don't just like start in 1950 and go through what came out or that sort of thing. You really follow the people, and that gives the story of Hollywood and the movie industry in this time of change. The big change is the antitrust ruling that came on in the end of the 1940s.
Yes.
And the secret studios, which produced, distributed, and exhibited movies.
And that was considered in restraint of trade.
Right.
They had to get rid of their theaters. And once they got rid of their theaters, they no longer had the policy of what was called block booking. And the theaters, and in those days, the prominent downtown theaters and theaters like the Hollywood could also present independent films not connected to the studio. So independents and the studios competed in a way that wasn't possible before. Mm-hmm. And it was the beginning of the end of the dominance of the old studios, and they knew it. And they delayed selling off their theaters as long as they could because they knew it was going to wreck their business model forever.
It seems like the antitrust laws, which came into effect, I think, because of the railroads and certain other monopolies at the turn in the Gilded Age and later, was a good thing. But when it came to movies, the antitrust notions were a really bad thing. And I'm not even sure if legally it could be said to apply to them because they weren't doing anything evil. It was just a business setup or arrangement. But, you know, that's a side issue. I don't know if it has any validity. I'm not an expert.
Well, one thing also is that it was instrumental in television not being taken over by the movie studios.
Right.
Because they had this antitrust thing, and especially Sarnoff at the Radio Corporation of America, which ran the National Broadcasting Company under General Electric, and he made sure that the people, the FCC, knew that the movie studios had broken the trust, and so they weren't allowed to get broadcast license. Now, I've wondered, you know, I think they wanted to do what was called theatrical television, where you would go to the theater and they would have a giant video screen.
Yes, yes, they did have that idea. Yes, they did it. It was an idea that didn't work, and they recognized that it didn't. Mm-hmm. It was a very short-lived experiment.
But that leads to them making movies different than television.
Absolutely. That was the underlying motivation of the revival of filmmaking in the 50s. The studios had to rethink in order to compete with television, which meant let's offer new technologies.
Motion pictures have been described as like looking at something through a keyhole. You see what is straight ahead, you hear what is straight ahead. And television up to the present, even more confined. But the pictures you are now going to see have no plot. They have no stars. This is not a stage play, nor is it a feature picture, nor a travelogue, nor a symphonic concert, nor an opera. But it is a combination of all of them. In fact, it is the first public demonstration of an entirely new medium, which we believe is going to revolutionize the technique of motion picture storytelling. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Cinerama.
We talked about Cinerama, CinemaScope, and the other widescreen, VistaVision, 3D. You couldn't have 3D. Color, spectacle, widescreen on TV. So you go to the movies for that. And that required a different kind of movie for the most part. They made the old-fashioned small drama as well. But then the amount and kind of content exploded exponentially in the 50s. The 50s is a period of great variety in movie making because the studios had to reinvent themselves to survive. Mm. They had to create it.
Now, I also understand in the late 40s, what was called that one small company. It had just initials, producers distributing something or other.
Yeah, PCR. Yes.
Yeah,
that was one of the Poverty Row studios.
Yeah,
right. So they were bought up by a British company, and this added a doorway for foreign films, especially British films, to start to be shown more on American screens.
It is the night of May the 16th, 1943. In all the skies of Europe at war, one squadron only is flying.
Enemy coast ahead.
Their task, to breach the great dams of the Ruhr Valley. Tonight, they are 617 Squadron, who are with the dam busters in action, boring at treetop height into the heart of the Third Reich. The human drama which preceded this incredible raid reveals the inspiration and obsession of one man with an idea.
But surely they must realize if we can burst those dams and flood the Ruhr Valley, they can save the thousands of...
And that, yes, there were a great many foreign films shown in the post-war period, beginning 47, 48.
Yeah.
An influx of foreign films. Movies became more international.
So in your book, you start off with looking at Louis B. Mayer and the other studio heads, and what happened to them is reflected about what was going to happen to the studios, which would
absolutely
turn into... But Mayer had been the king of Hollywood, in a sense, hadn't he?
Yes, the Hollywood emperor from 1924 with the founding of MGM. And then the unthinkable happened in May 1951, at the beginning of the period I'm talking about. Louis B. Mayer was deposed. King of the realm was deposed. Yeah. He was overthrown. Doris Sherry took his place. MGM changed, but the industry changed. If Louis B. Mayer could not survive the challenges of post-war, early 50s Hollywood filmmaking, who could?
Yeah.
The like model Domino changed, the business changed.
Like Domino, the other studios and studio chiefs tumbled in his wake.
Absolutely. At the end of the decade.
Yeah.
No, at the end of the decade, the only old-time mogul still standing was Jack Warner. And he lasted until 1967.
Wow.
Now, Daryl Zanuck, he stepped away from the studio and became...
He chose to leave.
Yeah.
He chose to leave.
And that's
then they brought him back.
Yeah, because he was being successful as an independent.
He saved the industry. People don't realize that the film that saved Hollywood in 1953 was a biblical epic in CinemaScope called The Robe. Did you guys see that?
I've seen it in the past, not recently.
I love the opening scene with Burton, and he's just the conversation, but you really have this set of this place and the soldiers working for the Roman Empire. It's very well done.
Jerusalem's no pleasure resort at its best. This is the worst. The feast they call the Passover. This is when their soothsayers tell them the Messiah will come.
Messiah? What's that?
King, Savior, Redeemer, Son of their God, and General Troublemaker.
He's coming here?
No one knows. No one knows if he even exists. He is, but he isn't. He hasn't come yet, but he's coming. Every year the same. You'll find out, Tribune, if you live long enough.
Thanks for the kind wish, Centurion.
It's very well done for what it is. It's terrific. But Daryl Zanuck bet the house on,
right,
we're going to survive television, we've got to give moviegoers something new. Let's give them this new practical widescreen. Cinerama was too big. Yeah. So let's give them a widescreen that's more manageable. CinemaScope. Mm. And if it had not succeeded, 20th Century Fox would have gone under. Maybe Hollywood would have gone under. But The Robe was a huge hit in 53. A huge hit. Hard to believe now, but it saved the industry.
You also mentioned Republic Pictures, which I thought was great to dig into what was going on. I guess considered the more lower end, but they were always striving. I mean, there was that John Wayne movie with the Quintel's Raiders, as Roy Rogers and John Wayne are in. I forget what it's called, but they would come up with a couple of good movies every now and then.
They were a lower ranked studio for sure. But what happened to Republic was also unnerving for the industry. It shuttered in 1957. Yeah. It died. RKO died, one of the big five. That died in the 50s.
And the other thing that
was in turmoil.
Yeah. The other thing we lost were the short subjects, or we were beginning to lose. The Three Stooges showed up for work and no, we're not doing it anymore. Goodbye. Thanks for everything. So long. And
the short subjects lasted the longest at Columbia.
Right.
They held on to those shorts longer than any other studio, but then they too went the way of all flesh.
Now then, you switched down to, at one point, to the actors and the other books that you've done on acting. And it's really nice how you examine the different main actors that were really kind of lead the era, but also the older actors. Here are these performers who premiered in movies in the early talkie days, and they had these rich individual voices. I mean, Edward G. Robinson, Bela Lugosi. Betty Davis, they all had a different unique voice, and they lasted, 40 years, 50 years in the business?
They did, but in the 50s, the old-timers who had been at the beginning of the talking picture era were still working, but they were older. It was interesting because I compared the senior class to the newcomers, and it was easier for men to get older on film than for women. The women had to make adjustments that the men don't have to make, didn't have to make. That's a double standard. And some people would argue that the double standard exists to the present day.
Yeah.
That there's age prejudice that's greater against women than men, which of course is outrageously unfair.
Right.
But people like Katharine Hepburn, Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, the divas of the 30s and the 40s, really had to work hard to maintain their position in the 50s. No, Betty Davis did not do very well in the 50s. She lasted longer than the others, but she didn't do well in the 50s.
Right.
Joan Crawford was very creative in the 50s, and Katharine Hepburn chose her parts carefully and was, and I suppose, had the most dignified of the three careers, because Betty Davis and Joan Crawford were sometimes reduced to axe-wielding murderers.
Right.
Murderers. Hepburn never killed anyone.
No, you're right.
We never saw her with an axe.
Mark Stanwyck made a terrific transition to television.
But Barbara Stanwyck's film career started in the early 30s.
Right.
Her real film career was over in 1957.
That's true.
And in the 50s, she made some very interesting films, but clearly heading toward the B rather than the A range. And 57, over. She lasted because of television, but her film career died. Joan Crawford continued to make movies, but we wonder how good her choices were. Straight Jacket, Berserk, I Saw What You Did, Trog. I mean, there were exploitation films, but they had Crawford in them.
And then
Betty Davis took any job she could get. She wanted to work. She was indiscriminate. She took good films, bad films, big parts, little parts, and she lasted a very long time at the cost of quality, actually.
What do you bring up with the later films of these aging actresses is that how much different the movies of the 50s looked from the films of the 40s. And then as these older actresses transitioned to B movies, William Castle films and others, the movies themselves don't look so good as the films from the 50s. In fact, especially the William Castle movies, they just look like TV shows.
Yes, and that began to happen in the 60s and into the 70s, where television and TV movies and films almost merged together, certainly at the lower end of the budget. Yes, that's very true.
And you can see what Andrew Saris back in 1981 or so said, that the 50s, of all the film decades he lived through, the 50s he loved the most. And I think it's because...
I agree with him there.
I think it has a lot to do with just how the movies just got bigger and better looking, and the acting got better, sound, all the production values improved. And yet, just on the... It's like silent movies were so wonderful, beautiful, well done. At their peak, just the sound was coming in. And I think a similar historical crux occurs in the late 50s.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And if I may say, I finished the book on the 50s, but my next project is, in a sense, part two, is Hollywood and the movies of the 60s. My opinion, the 50s and the 60s represented the apex of the Hollywood studio style.
Right.
And you're talking, Doug, about the excellence of the late silent film, which it's true, the most artistic silent films tended to be at the end when the system was about to die.
Right.
I would say the 50s into the 60s represent the last hurrah
right.
for the Hollywood golden age and the studio system. Excellence in
yeah.
production values
right.
and in performance, in technique, and often in content. It doesn't mean good movies haven't been made since the 60s.
Of course
they have.
Oh, yeah.
But that was a climax, 50s and 60s, and it was the end of the studio era. It took about 20 years for it to die completely.
So in the 60s book, you'll be talking the whole new Hollywood thing, which is really a 70s.
That's 70s.
Right.
It's building toward it.
Because of the relaxation in the MPAA and
absolutely.
Influence of foreign films and how you tell a story and what you focus on, et cetera. But so you've got
all of that. The production code.
Right.
Was finally overturned in 1968, allowing for a much franker and broader range of subject matter.
Yeah.
The films could be more adult or more candid. Doesn't mean they could be better.
Yeah.
But characters could swear, they could get away with crime, everybody could be sexier, a much more hedonistic view of the world. From the 50s, in that sense, may have been more conservative, and it was a religious time, and that was reflected
in
films as well.
It's all the biblical epics.
Absolutely, which I have to admit, I'm guilty. I love them.
You know, they could get away with stories about adultery and murder.
Exactly.
And stuff like that.
Oh, if it happened in the ancient world, you could do practically anything. If it was contemporary, you had to be very restricted.
I know. And you think of a movie like Mankiewicz's Three Faces of Eve, well, All About Eve. And that's set in the world of theater. And it's easy after what happened to, well, in comparison to Sunset Boulevard, it's easier to critique Hollywood if you set your story in the theater than it is to critique Hollywood by making a movie about Hollywood. So I think
But in the 50s, they did make movies, Hollywood on Hollywood.
That's right.
There's some great ones.
Yeah.
You remember The Bad and the Beautiful?
Exactly.
Of course, Sunset Boulevard, which is the greatest. The Big Knife. There were a number of very frank depictions of Hollywood morality in the 50s.
That's true,
and by the way, talking of Mr. Mayer, when he saw Sunset Boulevard, he went up to Billy Wilder afterwards and said, you have dishonored the industry that pays you your living. Because he thought it was a very negative depiction of Hollywood manners and morals. And in a way it is, but it's also a great film.
Amazing that a film like Asphalt Jungle comes out from MGM.
Absolutely. Interesting. Because that was when Dorie Sherry began to take over. And Dorie Sherry was interested in social issues and political issues in a way that Louis B. Mayer was not at all. He wanted to create idealized visions of Americana.
Mm-hmm.
He saw Asphalt Jungle. He went to Dorie Sherry and he said, I wouldn't walk across the street to see a film like this. He hated it.
Since I'm going to be busy with a lot of cases, I thought you might like to take a trip.
Where to?
Oh, I don't know. The coast, Florida, anywhere you like.
Could I, Uncle Lon? Anywhere? No fooling?
Yes, I think a change of scenery might be good for you.
Wait. You wait right here. I've got the most terrific idea.
Oh, Cuba. Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
Imagine me on this beach here in my green bathing suit. Yipe. I almost fought a white one the other day, but it wasn't quite extreme enough. I mean, don't get me wrong. If I really went in for the extreme, I would have bought a French one. Run for your lives, girls. A fleet thing. Oh, Uncle Lon, am I excited? Yipe! Look, Uncle Lon, isn't it romantic? Real palms and ocean and everything. Can that be this time of night? See who it is, Uncle Lon. Why are they pounding so? I'm scared, Uncle Lon.
Mayer originally loved Dorie Sherry, but they just went divergent paths.
I think I have a very good and dramatic account of their history, beginning and then the falling out.
Exactly,
they were very different people.
Anyway.
that relationship was doomed.
It was doomed from the start. Matthew, I'm sorry I interrupted you when you were
I just move on back with what was in the book. You talked about the older actors in the 50s. Jimmy Stewart was really successfully able to kind of maintain an edge because he took chances with his characters.
Yes, he did.
And that's kind of reflective of his experience during the war and what he went through there. And so he really knew how to dig down. Though when you look at him in that after the Thin Man movie, he goes pretty crazy in that. So he's always had that.
The best thing that ever happened
to James Stewart was his association with Hitchcock. And working with Hitchcock, he did agree to play characters who were obsessive and neurotic and who were not the idealistic country boy that had been his earlier image.
That's right.
But so also he was able to remake himself in the 50s, and it was easier for him to do it than it was for actresses at his same stature.
It was easier for the guys to get away with things. He also did
himself.
Right. He also had to deal with through Wasserman, his agent, and later the head of Universal, in which he shared in the profits of the movies.
And that was the nail in the coffin also for the studio system, because his agent, Lou Wasserman, negotiated with Universal that he would get a share of the profits of his films. One of the films that he made, called Winchester 73, was unexpectedly a huge hit. James Stewart had an amazing payday. When other actors at his level saw that, they wanted their agents to negotiate a percentage. The moguls were furious. They didn't want the actors sharing in that way. They wanted them to have a salary and to move on.
They didn't want sharing
in the profits. It was the beginning of the end as well.
Right.
It eroded the system.
Now, new to the system were these new actors that began appearing in the 50s, and especially out of the Actors Studio.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned in the book that for this type of acting, the method, it seems to call, people associated with Stanislavski, but actually it's Stella Adler, whose students were really big in the movies, especially Marlon Brando. Is that, you brought that out.
No, absolutely. The work that was being done at the Actors Studio, founded in 1947, had an enormous impact on movie acting to this day. The style of acting, Matthew, which you identify as the method, was a way of giving the actor an inner life. And it was about what's connected to the inside of the character and to your inside. So it was a more personal, intimate, and emotionally charged kind of acting.
Yeah, the exemplars
of this are the great James Stewart, James Dean, Marlon Brando, and Montgomery Clift, the big three.
They are
among the greatest and most influential actors in Hollywood history, and their heyday was the 50s.
Right, and would you say that the method was actually more suited to the screen than to the stage?
Absolutely. That's a great irony, because the Actors Studio, two blocks from Broadway on West 44th Street, it's still there, was intended to train theater actors. But it's a style that's ideally suited to the camera and intimacy.
Never thought of that before. We only have about 7 minutes left.
A book by Alexander McKendrick, which is actually a collection of his teachings about film. And in one, he says that what they found out in the early days of film is that you can actually photograph thought. The inner workings, and that's what the method starts to bring out with actors.
Absolutely. You look at Marlon Brando in any of his films, and you can see his character's thinking. It's not so much what they say. It's what's going on beneath the words and behind the eyes.
Right.
And that's a movie method. That's not going to get you a lot of traction on the stage. You got to project to the audience and to the balcony.
You have to shout into the darkness.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In film, you project to the camera. It's closer, more intimate. The method is ideally a movie style of acting.
Just quickly, we've only got about 7 or 5 minutes left. So if it ends abruptly, let me just quickly say that
You've been listening to an interview which myself, Matthew, and D.K. Holm conducted with film historian Foster Hirsch, the author of Hollywood and the Movies of the 50s, The Collapse of the Studio System, The Thrill of Cinerama, and The Invasion of the Ultimate Body Snatcher Television. Film 11 will be back again next week. So till then, keep watching the screens.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with